From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now, coming up, one father's quest to remember and honor his son on Memorial Day. But first, we're remembering the life of Nobel laureate John Nash. Nash and his wife, Alicia, were killed in a car crash in New Jersey on Saturday. When he was 21 years old, Nash authored one of the most influential ideas of the 20th century in game theory. It was his doctoral dissertation. It explained how to win when you face difficult choices and you don't know what your competitors are doing. And that wasn't even considered his greatest work. But as his renown grew, Nash's mind fell apart, ravaged by schizophrenia. His story became familiar to many people because it was told in the 2001 film A Beautiful Mind. Russell Crowe played John Nash. Christopher Plummer played his doctor.
There's no one there, John. There's no one there.
He's right there. He's right there.
Stop. I don't know anything. Stop. I don't know anything. My name is John Nash. I'm being held against my will.
That's from the film A Beautiful Mind, based on the biography written by Sylvia Nasser, journalism professor at Columbia University. She joins us from New York City. Sylvia, what was John Nash's life like at age 86?
Well, very few lives have a third act, but his did. And he got his life back. All the things that you take for granted in anyone else's life, like having a driver's license, traveling, being invited to conferences, all those things that were impossible and seemed to be impossible forever now were possible. And he lived with Alicia. They eventually got remarried in 2001.
When had they gotten divorced?
They got divorced about 5 years into his illness, that is, in the 60s. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia at age 30. He blamed Alicia for hospitalizing him against his will, and she eventually had no choice but to divorce. But a few years later, when he was incarcerated in a hospital in Virginia, he wrote to her and begged her to take him in, and she did. And for the next 30 years, he lived with her and their son, Johnny, across the street from the Princeton train station. And Alicia supported both of them. The son got sick at age 15. Alicia commuted into Manhattan, working at jobs like at Con Edison and Blue Cross, getting up at 4:30 in the morning. And she made it possible for Nash's mind to heal.
How was it that he was able to not only keep his life together, but also excel? He apparently once wrote that he simply decided to return to rationality.
Well, he did say that often. As his symptoms became less urgent, he was able to manage them to some degree, the same way that anyone manages the symptoms of any chronic illness. He didn't mean that he willed his illness away, but as he started aging out of it, he had more control, and he was motivated to exert that control.
And was he able to do mathematics again?
He did, but as he once said at an international psychiatry conference, when he was introduced as, this walking miracle, He got up and said, well, it's like an artist having had, some long-term physical illness, recovering, and then not being able to paint again. Losing those years from 30 to 60, they couldn't be replaced.
Was John Nash, I realize we may not even be talking about him right now, if he hadn't been the subject of your book and a movie, and if he hadn't had schizophrenia, if he hadn't made a name for himself with the disease as well, what is his legacy now? And do you think it bears any resemblance to what it would have been if he had not had severe mental illness?
Certainly within mathematics, he will be remembered as one of the greatest mathematicians of the post-World War II era. Within economics, he'll be remembered for his transformative work in game theory. I think to everybody else, his life is an inspiration. He recovered from a disease that most people have long believed that you can never recover from. He didn't fit the popular stereotype of people with schizophrenia. He was supported by, you know, his loving family, as are so many nameless people with that illness. And at the end of the day, what he and Alicia did was to take care of their adult son who lived with them, who suffers from schizophrenia. And that was their life. So at the end, he not only survived himself, but he really was a devoted father and husband. And I think that he got great satisfaction from that.
Nice to talk to you about the subject of your book called A Beautiful Mind, The Life and Mathematical Genius of Nobel Laureate John Nash. Sylvia Nasser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today, communities across the country are marking this Memorial Day holiday with ceremonies and parades. Many people go to cemeteries to pay respect at the graves of loved ones who served in the military. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock has the story of one of those military veterans and a special tradition inspired by a father's love for his fallen son.
Here, you want to put this one in, Kaylee? Wait a minute, I'll start it.
It's windy, Mom.
How far deep do they go?
For the last 4 years, hundreds of people have volunteered to place American flags on the more than 60,000 graves at the Massachusetts National Cemetery on Cape Cod. On Saturday morning, Liz Monahan was there. She came with her daughter and her two grandchildren.
I thought it would be a nice thing for the kids. They're only 4 and a half, and it would be a respectful thing to do on a memorial weekend.
Paul Monty started this Memorial Day tradition. It's called Operation Flags for Vets. He did it because he wanted to make sure all of the graves at this cemetery had flags on them for the Memorial Day holiday. One of those graves belongs to his son, Jarrett. He was killed in Afghanistan nearly 9 years ago.
Things haven't changed much. You know, you try to tell people. It's a hole in your heart that just won't close. It just goes on and on and on.
Jared Monty died when his unit was ambushed by the Taliban on a remote mountaintop in 2006. A rocket-propelled grenade cut him down the third time he tried to save a fellow soldier who was wounded. For that action, Jared Monty was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. Chris Chaka was at the National Cemetery on Saturday. He's a Marine Corps vet, and he came because he's known Paul and the Monty family since he was a kid.
I think it's great, the support he gets from everybody out there in the community is great. So I think it's a good way to remember his son's memory.
Memory is what this holiday is all about. Jane Zolkevitz was volunteering to help place the American flags for the first time.
I came because my father, who was a World War II vet, just passed a couple months ago. It's just an incredible amount of joy that my dad brought me, and he's no longer here, and I just wanted to respect him and all the other vets today.
Another volunteer, Ken Gidney, comes to the cemetery every year to help place the American flags. He served in the Iraq War in 2006 and 2007.
Oh, again, just like, you know, last year and the year before, it just shows respect. You know, we're all respecting one another as veterans, and, you know, people get patriotic this time of year, and it's good to see that there's about 100 people sitting right here in this little lot, you know, doing their part, and within an hour we'll have it all done.
Paul Monty has always said Operation Flags for Vets is not about his son. He says it's about all of the nation's veterans. But as gratifying as it is to see so many people at the cemetery every year, he says it never replaces the hole in his heart.
I'd like people to try to understand that label, Gold Star Family. People who have lost a child in combat, you're going to grieve forever. You lose a parent, you've lost your past. But you lose a child and you've lost your future.
Paul Monty still drives his son's old Dodge Ram pickup truck. A songwriter in Nashville heard that story on Here and Now in 2011. She turned it into this country song recorded by Lee Brice. It won Country Music Song of the Year in 2013.
I drive your truck.
true.
This song is now a symbol for all the Gold Star families in the country, families whose stories haven't been told like the Montys. They're holding on to something, too. It might be a shirt or a pair of boots their loved ones wore. On this Memorial Day, they're holding those things extra tight. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock. If you saw this tear rolling down on my face, hey man, I'm trying to be tough.
Those are the sounds of a whitewater rafting trip on the Kings River near Fresno, California. Thanks, though, to a record low snowpack, the foam and chaos of Big Rapids will be short-lived this summer for some rivers in the Sierra Nevada. Alice Daniel from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
Justin Butchert is prepping for a two-day rafting trip. Step one, throwing ice into coolers.
I mean, this is our only form of refrigeration up there.
Butchert is the owner of Kings River Expeditions.
This is the first time I've packed food in 25 years. You know, I just do everything now. We used to have a full staff doing this, and we don't have that anymore.
Butchert says he has the same number of employees as in past summers, but they're working fewer hours. In the best of years, his company stays open until the 1st of September and guides about 6,000 folks down miles of roaring rapids.
And this year we'll probably do 800 people. And be done before the end of May.
His two competitors on the Kings River haven't been open for the past 3 years. But Butchert says he can't imagine hanging up his paddle. It's what he does. The same goes for Tom Moore, owner of Sierra South in Kernville, the hub of whitewater recreation in the Southern Sierra.
If we stopped today, said, okay, that's it, and next year was a big wet year, we'd go crazy.
Moore's guided trips on the wild and scenic Kern River for 30 years. The rafting season will be shorter this year, he says, but they're still fun to be had.
I have really nice tubes that have mesh floors in them so you don't hit your hiney on rocks as you're going down.
But lower down the river, there's just not enough water for companies to stay open this year. Darren Nilsson of Rivers End Rafting says this past winter proved depressing.
I had my fingers crossed. I was saying my prayers, I was doing the rain dance, and I was sure that at some point the snow was going to start falling in the mountains.
But instead, Nilsson says, he had to send out emails telling his employees not to show up this summer. For Here and Now, I'm Alice Daniel.
Grilling a burger this Memorial Day will cost you more than it did last year. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says the price of ground beef is up about 14%, a kind of sad fact for this unofficial start to summer in the grilling season. But if you want to use less meat and still get more flavor out of your burger or your fish or veggies, listen up. In May of 2011, Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst brought host Robin Young some recipes for rubs and marinades and what she modestly calls the best barbecue sauce. While you warm up the barbecue, let's listen back to that conversation.
A rub is a dry infusion of flavor. In front of you, there's two little jars. This little green-looking one here, This is a combination of fennel seeds, which are really aromatic, dried rosemary, red chili pepper, ground ginger, salt, pepper, and some light brown sugar.
Oh, my.
And the idea is that this is dry. You can make this mixture, and it will keep for months. It'll keep through the whole grilling season. And what you do is you literally rub that, whether it's a steak or chicken or ribs or fish or a piece of tofu. You pat it down on the food. You let it infuse. It looks like it's doing nothing, but in fact it is. And then the rub stays on when you put it on the grill. It generally protects the food. It won't burn, and it infuses it with all these herbs and spices.
You've got another one here.
I have another one. That one is kind of red, and we have pictures on the website. That's a smoked Spanish paprika. So it's sweet and smoky and hot, and there's cumin in there and chili powder and, again, salt and pepper.
How do you get the smoked paprika? Did you buy it that
way? Yeah, you know, you can find it now in specialty food stores and grocery stores. It's just a Spanish paprika. There's a sweet version and a hot. You can use either one. That is amazing on a flat iron steak or a flank steak, pork chop or ribs. It's also good on very thick, oily fish, like a bluefish, where there's so much flavor that the smoked paprika and the chili really can hold up to the oiliness of the fish.
There's the rub. I had to get it in there. And again, posted at our website, herenow.org. But you've also got marinades and sauces.
Right.
What's the difference?
Okay, so a marinade is like, think of like putting something into a bubble bath, right? You're sort of infusing a liquid. A marinade is wet, and what you do is you take your food, again, it could be red meat, it could be poultry, it could be fish, and you put it into this wet mixture, and you let it sit anywhere from an hour to 48 hours. For instance, one of my favorite marinades, I love butterfly of lamb, which is a leg of lamb where the bone has been taken out and the two flaps of meat open up and it looks like a butterfly. One of the most unusual marinade ingredients is yogurt, whole yogurt. Mm. It tenderizes the meat. I do whole yogurt, fresh mint leaves, olive oil, coarsely ground pepper, and a little balsamic vinegar, and I let the lamb sit, sometimes for 2 days. Now, one of the things about marinades, people say, oh, I forgot to do a marinade, I don't have time. Even if a piece of food sits in a wet marinade for 15 or 20 minutes, it will make a difference.
Okay, just, I mean, it seems obvious, but it's marinating in the fridge.
It's marinating in the fridge,
right.
Always.
Right.
One really important thing is you never want to add lemon juice to a marinade, particularly when you're marinating fish, because it cooks the fish. Not quite literally, but the citrus breaks down the enzymes in the fish and it starts to almost cook itself. So you only add the lemon juice or lemon zest 5 minutes before it goes on the grill.
So that's a marinade, and you mentioned the yogurt. But just what are some of the things you can marinate in? It can be anything.
I love using Asian flavors, a soy-based marinade with fresh ginger, smashed lemongrass, a little sesame oil, fresh lime juice at the end. Lime is a great marinade ingredient. A marinade can be as simple as coarsely ground pepper and fresh lime juice. But again, if you're doing the citrus, you'd only keep it on for 5 minutes.
Right.
And you can just put wine on top of something and let it sit. All of these liquids like soy sauce, Worcestershire sauce, wine, yogurt, they break food down and tenderize it.
Great.
So that by the time it hits the grill, you're 10 steps ahead of everybody else.
I've done apple juice on occasion.
Apple juice is great. Cranberry juice.
Nothing else. Okay. So that's the marinade. Barbecue sauces. You've got one here.
I do. I very modestly call it the best barbecue sauce. this took me 5 minutes to make. It's full of complex flavors. It's got ginger and garlic. It has maple syrup. It's got some ketchup. It's got some Chinese chili paste. It's sweet. It's spicy. This stuff is so good. Now, the sauce comes towards the end of the grilling. If you put a rub on first, that's fine. If you've marinated first, that's fine. But the sauce gets brushed on in the last few minutes because you don't want it burning. I have a plate of barbecue chicken in front of you. This chicken was grilled, and then the barbecue sauce was then just brushed right onto it in the last minute. Or you can brush sauce on at the table or serve it separately. But taste that.
I was going to say, or you can eat it with a spoon.
I won't even tell you how much I ate while I was making it. There's something really pleasing about this. It's a 10-minute process. Isn't that great?
It's just wonderful in and of itself. And I taste all these different tastes that you listed. But, you know, is this really that much better? I mean, it's yours and it's great. But is it that much better than bottled? You know, is there any bottled you could see using?
Yeah, there are great bottled barbecue sauces. The thing about making a homemade sauce is, okay, I'll be realistic here because I tend to exaggerate. 10 minutes tops, and you get that fabulous flavor.
Really?
That barbecue sauce will keep for a good 2 weeks. If you wanted to can it, it would keep for a year. You know exactly what's in it. There's no preservatives. There's no stabilizers. There's no corn syrup. That's my problem with a lot of these bottled sauces is they pump them up with a lot of sugars and stabilizers. But sure, if it's the difference between getting you outside and cooking and not, go for the bottled.
And if you haven't had a chance to make Kathy Gunst's world's greatest barbecue sauce and you don't have anything handy in a bottle, just what else might you just slap on a chicken on a grill towards the end? Anything you can?
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted something sweet, you could just brush on honey or maple syrup because it's thick. But you could also brush on a little bit of chili paste mixed with lime juice or a little bit of sesame oil brushed with a little soy sauce. These are just flavor blasts. They're really potent flavors, and they wake up grilled foods.
That was Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz speaking with Robin Young back in May of 2011. If you've got a favorite marinade, we want to know about it. Pass it on at hereandnow.org. Amazon and European countries have been feuding over taxes, and it looks like Amazon has lost the battle. The company is no longer funneling its European sales through Luxembourg, which has famously low taxes. This change could cost Amazon billions of dollars, but it could also curb criticism amid EU investigations into how Amazon and other American companies pay taxes in Europe. For a closer look at the issue, we're joined from New York by Ali Velshi, host of Ali Velshi on Target on Al Jazeera America. Ali, can you explain Amazon's old taxpaying strategy?
Here's the issue. Amazon says it has a European headquarters, and the European headquarters is in Luxembourg. But it so happens that Amazon has an agreement with Luxembourg to pay lower taxes on income generated in Europe. Now, what European countries are saying is that this is unfair. So the UK has passed a law, it went into effect in April, that says if you do business in the United Kingdom, but you route those profits through another country, in this case Luxembourg, then you are not only going to pay those taxes in Great Britain, but you are going to pay a 25% punitive tax for avoiding those taxes. Now, Amazon says it wasn't attempting to dodge taxes, but the net result is that Amazon has decided that it is, in fact, going to route those taxes through the United Kingdom. It started doing it in Italy and in Spain, effective immediately.
Okay, so Amazon was pretty much pressured into this. How much is it going to cost the company?
Well, in 2013, Amazon paid taxes on about $700 million worth of sales in the UK, but it apparently did about $7 billion worth of sales, so about 10 times what it reported. Now, that would be routing about 90% of its business through Luxembourg or other countries. The tax saving on that would have been upward of $70 million that Amazon saved in 2013 alone.
How important, how lucrative is the European market to Amazon, especially compared to the U.S.?
Well, it's a big deal. It's not anywhere near what it is in the United States. But remember that the United States is what you would call a saturated market. There are people, I'm one of them, that does probably the majority of their shopping online. Europe is a slightly less mature market. So for Amazon and particularly for Google, which is doing a lot of business in Europe now, these are big growth markets. On the other hand, Europe is stagnating. It has not seen real growth since the recession. They are trying to get more business friendly in Europe, but basically the position that the UK has taken is to say, we'll be friendly for business. We'll even charge you lower tax rates, but you can't be dishonest. You can't cheat. It's unclear who's going to change what laws, but it is clear that the pressure is on these tech companies to change the way they do business, pay taxes in the countries where they do business, and that'll make the Europeans happy.
And will consumers be happy, customers like you or Amazon customers be happy? Because presumably Amazon's going to have to make up the money that it's losing on paying increased taxes. It's going to have to make it up somehow.
It's unclear how this affects the consumer. Does Amazon just say, all right, well, this was good while it lasted. We're just going to take lower profits. Or are they going to somehow increase their prices? That's yet to be determined. But this is going to unfold very quickly because this law in the UK is now in place and the tech companies are going to start to implement it everywhere they are.
Ali Velshi hosts Ali Velshi on Target on Al Jazeera America. Nice to talk to you, Ali.
Always a pleasure.
23 states across the country now allow marijuana to be used for medical purposes. Four of those states, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska, have legalized the drug for recreational use as well. And that's led to a boom in the edible pot market. In Colorado, pot that you can eat makes up nearly half of the state's legal consumption. You can buy cannabis-infused brownies, truffles, and even ice cream. Sweet Mary Jane Edibles is based in Boulder, Colorado. Karen Lazarus owns the bakery. It's not a retail space, that's not allowed, but it's where baked goods are made and sold to hundreds of dispensaries across the state. Lazarus is now sharing her weed baking wisdom in a new cookbook. It's called Sweet Mary Jane, 75 Delicious Cannabis-Infused High-End Desserts. Welcome to Here and Now. And does your mother know you're in this business?
Yes.
And what does she have to say about you?
Oh, she is so supportive. She's been supportive from the get-go. I think her biggest worry when I first started in 2010 was that I was going to go to jail. She just couldn't wrap her head around This is a legal industry in our state. It's a wonderful, wonderful industry to be in.
Okay.
I'm excited.
So tell us how you got into it in the first place.
I've always liked to bake, but I wasn't really thrilled about the idea of a conventional bakery. I wanted to do something different. And I baked with cannabis before, and now that it's legal, I thought I can really start experimenting with flavors. I just started practicing and then applied for my license, and boom.
So what do you make with cannabis, with pot?
One of our top sellers is something called True Confections, and it's a little peanut butter truffle, and it's sandwiched between two pretzels and then dipped in dark chocolate and drizzled with white chocolate. So that sweet and salty just, you know, hits the nail on the head. People love that.
And where is the pot in there?
The pot is infused into the peanut butter truffle.
Oh, yeah. So this is interesting because in a lot of the recipes that I've looked at, you have things like Buddha butter,
mm-hmm.
which has buds of what in it?
Well, you start out with cannabis for those, and then that cannabis is infused either into coconut oil or butter, and then you have to strain out all the flour, the cannabis, so that you have pure, clean oil.
And then you just kind of fold it in as you would any sort of shortening or butter.
Yeah, you use it in baking the same way that you would any kind of butter, oil.
You don't just kind of toss the pot in.
Oh, no. That's what we did in college, and they were terrible.
So how are they any better this way? It's the same basic ingredient.
Well, first of all, there's no little bits of cannabis floating around in your brownie. The oil is strained. The oil is clean. So there's no bits of grass in there. You know, you've strained it so that you have a nice, clean oil that you're baking with.
And how does it affect the taste?
Canna butter or Buddha butter has a fairly strong cannabis taste. So we work with different ingredients to kind of mask that. And, you know, chocolate is a wonderful thing to mask it. Peanut butter works, coffee. But you can still taste the cannabis in that. After a couple of years of working with cannabis, we decided, what can we do to change things a little bit so that taste is masked even more. So we started infusing sugar. And I show that in the cookbook, how to make infused sugar. And that definitely masks the taste of cannabis quite a bit more than canna butter.
I mean, as a chef, does it feel awkward to put in an ingredient that you're then trying to mask the taste of?
Well, the thing about cannabis is cannabis is used to help people feel better. I mean, most of the people who buy our products, we have a medical-only bakery. And the people who use our products, for the most part, not all of them, are using cannabis to relieve symptoms. So if there's a little bit of cannabis flavor in there, they're going to be okay with that.
And with the flavor, because they're going to get the side effects. And what are the side effects of eating, say, cannabis-infused apple pie?
Okay, depending on what you're treating. So people who are treating seizures, this is what people that we sell to tell us. They are having far less seizures. People with post-traumatic stress are dealing with life a lot better. We sell to Parkinson's patients. We sell to, it's helping migraines. It's helping MS patients, Crohn's disease. People are finding relief.
And psychologically, do they get high?
Yes, our products will definitely make you high.
Are you allowed to sell some of these pot-infused desserts to children who have a medical need?
If a child has seen two physicians and has their prescription card to purchase, have their parents purchase a product for them, they are allowed to use them.
So that must put the onus on you to be very careful about dosing, because the dosage, the amount, it really has a dramatic effect, right?
Oh, it's huge. We have everything that we make in our kitchen lab tested. We know the cannabinoid level of the products that we make.
That's the level of THC. Maybe you should explain what that is.
THC is the psychoactive. CBD is the cannabinoid that people are using to treat seizures, especially in children. CBN helps with sleep.
How did you learn about the dosing? There must be a lot of trial and error on your part, at least I would think in the beginning, was there?
Yes, absolutely. So this is the first batch of brownies I ever made. Somebody had a dispensary here, and this was way before we were regulated the way we are now. This could never happen now. They gave me some cannabis to try. So I went home and I made the can of butter and I made these brownies that I knew were delicious, but I didn't know how much to put in. I looked on YouTube and read the internet and did all kinds of things to figure it out and came up with what I thought sounded good. And I thought, all right, just do it. So I baked them. And because I was unsure, I was afraid to try them. So I just thought, I just need to try them for flavor. So I took maybe a thumbnail piece. And I was sitting there, and like 2 hours later, I was sitting with my daughter, who was, you know, in her 20s, and I said, Lucy, I feel like I'm high. She said, you can't get high from that amount, Mom. Well, yeah, you can. So I knew I put way too much cannabis in. So I started, you know, dialing it back. I wasn't selling these at the time. I was just trying to figure out how to dose something. So I was able to dial it back, but not until I started having things lab tested did I know exactly what I was putting in there.
Things are changing so fast. What do you foresee for the business in the future? I mean, I would think maybe some new recipes, but aside from that.
Oh, yeah, we're working on all new recipes right now because most of my recipes are in this cookbook. So I figured let's change it up, give people some new things. What I hope is that federally this becomes legal. What I see for my business is it's just growing. The thing that makes me the happiest in this industry, I started it because I love to bake. I'm in it now because I love to hear what patients have to say about using the products. We get calls all the time, people thanking us for our products. And yes, we have patients that are in their 80s using our products and thanking us. It's getting rid of their pain. They can sleep.
I can see how heartening that is, but I guess I just wonder, this is changing so rapidly for everybody, particularly for those people in Colorado, and for you when you hear from an 80-year-old, who's mm-hmm. eating pod-infused brownies
right.
or toffee or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it must be strange, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that people can freely speak about. It was a secret for so long. People didn't talk about cannabis, and we didn't see these older patients walking in to a dispensary, sitting down with a bud tender and talking about, I need to use cannabis. I'm on all this medication. Nothing's working for me. Help me. Yeah, we can talk about it. That's what I'm hoping. We see this federally.
Karen Lazarus owns Sweet Mary Jane Bakery, based in Boulder, Colorado. She's also author of the new cookbook called Sweet Mary Jane, 75 Delicious Cannabis-Infused High-End Desserts. Nice to talk to you.
Same. Thank you.
Looking to Europe now, the debate is escalating before the European Parliament over seal hunting. The Inuit people of Greenland are trying to get a ban on the sale of seal products overturned. The European Union imposed that ban 5 years ago, and the Inuit say it's destroyed the way they make a living because it's wiped out the export of seal fur. The BBC's Malcolm Brabant has this report.
The Greenlanders were in good voice as they left the Danish capital for a clash of cultures. They're convinced that the European Union simply doesn't understand the realities and hardship of life in the Arctic Circle. Although the traditional hunters have an exemption, the ban on seal products has killed the market for fur, and exports are down by 90%.
We would like European parliamentarians to hear that the Inuit exemption is an empty box and is useless at the moment.
Among those on the bus, a tiny woman with delicate tattoos on her face and hands. She'd just flown in from northern Canada to show that the Inuit are all one people and are suffering in the same way. Her name is Ayu Peter.
when a man catches a seal in Nunavut, he shares it with the community. And when you live in an area where you cannot grow anything else and where you have the highest rate of unemployment and where you have the highest cost of living, it is vital that the hunter is able to share his food for free with the community.
But how has the ban affected that?
He's not able to sell the seal skin for the same price. Now he can't even buy gas and ammunition to provide for the family. And the community is suffering. Community is going hungry.
This is the sound of a father and son opening fire on a seal from a skiff in Greenland. This is the true image of seal hunting, according to the country's deputy foreign minister, Kai Andersen.
The seal skin ban is based on images of baby seals being clubbed. Baby seals have never been clubbed in Greenland, ever. Baby seals have never been shot in Greenland. People live off adult seal because that's the sustainable way to use a resource.
Greenpeace is urging the European Union to launch an information campaign to help the Inuit regain their lost fur sales. Its spokesman on the Arctic is John Bergwald. Do you think that Greenpeace has to bear any responsibility for damaging the economies of the Inuit?
There's no doubt that the campaign which Greenpeace led in the 70s and early 80s, even though it was only directed towards the industrialized seal hunt in Canada, had an unfortunate negative impact on Inuit seal hunt as well. And that's something which we're now trying to make amends for, amongst others, by trying to tell the EU member states that they should open up their borders for Inuit-based seal hunt products and inform the citizens that there's a huge difference between indigenous seal hunt and the commercial seal hunt in Canada.
So should people regard that as an apology?
Of course. Greenpeace has apologised. Well, we apologised the first time back in already 1986, and we apologised many times since. And I would like to once again give my deepest, most sincere apologies to the Inuit communities which have been harmed by our campaign in the 70s and 80s.
It's a nice start, but sorry is not enough. Sorry is not going to feed our community. Sorry is not going to provide pride to our community. Sorry is not going to pass on our tradition. Greenpeace now needs to provide financial compensation.
The signals coming out of Brussels are that the Inuit are fighting a losing battle because the European public appetite for seal fur has evaporated. Campaigners on behalf of the Greenlanders predict that failure to convince Europe to change its mind will result in most hunters being forced to live on welfare and to abandon a way of life that's existed for thousands of years.
That report from the BBC's Malcolm Brabant. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Robin Young and Jeremy Hobson will be back tomorrow. We hope you enjoyed this Memorial Day holiday. I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.